Questions? Going on questions?
We just want to learn.
So, kind of thinking ahead to the exam, which is, you know, something like 10 days away or something like that. And these sorts of problems, right? So, in terms of exam content, we can either make them unrealistic, like in 200 with 1, 2, and 3 ohm resistors, or we can make them more interesting, in which case one has to solve them with a calculator and or a computer.
How would you do that with tests?
Well, that's what I'm cogitating on. So one possibility that occurs to me is that you all probably have laptops. Is that true? Anyone not have a laptop? Everyone's got a laptop? My bet is that you haven't taken advantage of the free Mathematica distribution you can get on your laptop.
I did.
I don't know how.
It's moderately simple. Yeah, I can't remember how you have to find it. I actually looked for it before class. I couldn't find it immediately, so it's not exactly trivial. So you tell them that you're a student, and then they have to contact somebody locally to confirm that you're a student.
Okay.
And then. Oh, that was enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe for faculty it's more. I don't know.
Oh, and then can you only use it when you're on our Wi-Fi or whatever?
No.
You can use it any place. It's for home use.
Okay.
It'll die in May.
Yeah.
But you can, if you're a student, and you should be again, then you can re-up it and it'll be good the next year.
Okay.
And I think if everyone did that, I would not be opposed to having you use Mathematica during the exam. But obviously everyone has to be able to do it. Or at least everyone but one or something like that, because I've got a copy on my machine. So is everyone going to go do that? You already did it. You've got it. There's no reason not to, right? That's a $1,000 program that you can have for free. I think so. There's a student edition that's cheaper, which you could also get, and it's fully functional. But I think even that is like $500 or something like that. It's not cheap. So we decided that everyone's going to get Mathematica on their laptops for free, right? You can get it for free.
Yeah. Didn't we need it for Jim's lab?
No.
I thought we did.
Yeah. So if you've already done it, then we're good. So let's plan on having Mathematica available for the exam that's in something like 10 days or something like that. And if that doesn't work out, you got to tell me, right? At least 3 days before the exam or something like that.
So
I'm not sure all of you have, so I know that the TI-89s would allow you to do complex numbers in row reduced echelon form, but I'm not sure about like an 83, and I'm not sure you all have 89s. Does everyone have an 89?
Yeah,
you have a supercomputer, but and it could do complex numbers and matrices.
Pretty color screen.
But I think people don't have that, so I think there's no reason. Everyone does have a laptop, and Mathematica will solve everything, and then even on the final we could do maybe more interesting problems then.
See, when you use the word interesting, it's scary.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I told you the claim was that when the prof got a haircut, he became nastier.
You never said that.
I did say that.
He did say that.
Would we email you our notebook or just copy down our answers for
Well, I haven't cogitated, I guess, on that level of details. I was thinking that you could just copy down the answer for what the currents are, but maybe if something were more complicated, you could email the notebook. I don't know. Just copying down the answer seems probably good enough.
So it's
going to
be like simple.
It would be, well, you know, you say simple. I don't have my nice, pretty example here, but that's something that's quite doable, right? With the 13 nodes and that mess of resistors.
I don't know. I could spend probably 4 hours on
it. Yeah, I wouldn't do that. But so the flip side of it is, I probably wouldn't take off many points if you didn't get the numerical value, right? The hard part is setting up the equations. Okay, so this all comes in the context of, you know, solving moderately complicated circuits. And the reason this could have occurred earlier in this class in the context of DC circuits, but we waited until we had something interesting like L's and C's, because the upshot is that we can treat inductors and capacitors as if they were resistors, but with some complex resistance, which is technically speaking impedance. So for the inductor, it's I omega L, and for a capacitor, it's 1 over I omega C. And those come from taking derivatives or integrals of e to the I omega t, which is kind of the overall sinusoidal drive that we're thinking about. If the drive isn't exactly sinusoidal, you can still use these techniques because you can use superposition and Fourier series to map any periodic signal into a bunch of harmonic waves. Okay, so you've known for several years about Kirchhoff's and his laws. One rule is that if we add up the voltage drops going around in a circuit, we have to get zero. And another law is that if we add up the currents going into a junction, we have to get zero. So to kind of give you some examples of this, we've got, when we apply these rules to pieces of circuits, if we're fighting the current like this, then we're going uphill and we're going to have a plus IR in Kirchhoff's laws. If we're going with the flow, then we're going downhill and we're going to have terms like that. Similarly, when we're going through batteries in this kind of normal direction, then we're going uphill. If we're using a battery in this direction, then we're going downhill. Okay, so with those, we can kind of look at a loop. So here I have a blue loop. So with resistor number 2, I'm going with the flow. With resistor number 3, I'm fighting the flow. With resistor number 4, I'm going with the flow. So I get that equation. And of course, I went uphill through this battery. There's no reason that I have to include a battery. This brown loop is another possibility. So if I start here, I'm going with the flow through I5. I'm fighting the flow with I4, and I'm going with the flow with I3. So I get that equation. And we also have these current equations, that the sum of the currents going in equals the sum of the currents going out, or with sines, the sum of the net current going in has to be zero. So here, I1 is going in, and I3 and I4 are going out, so we get this collection of sines. So this is kind of how you solve these problems at the 200 level. It's a perfectly good way of solving it. If we did this, we would have 5 unknowns, the various currents, and we need 5 equations in order to solve for those unknowns. And typically, we would have a couple of node laws, and we would have 3 loop laws, and we'd combine them all with row-reduced echelon form in your calculators and get a nice answer. So there's nothing wrong with that approach. It's kind of the maximal approach. That is to say, it gives you the most number of knowns compared to any of these other equations. The other equation methods, the idea is to automatically solve one of these 2 equations and therefore reduce the number of unknowns, reduce the number of equations to get kind of simpler results. And, you know, your mileage may vary which one of these 2 methods is the simplest one. Generally speaking, the node method is the one that I would say is generically the simplest, but the mesh method also has its supporters. So with the mesh method, we imagine that there are these circular currents that are flowing in loops. So here I have IA that's flowing around in this loop, and I have IB that's flowing around in this loop, and I have IC that's flowing around in that loop. And if I focus, for example, on this resistor here, R1, the current that's going through it is IA in the positive direction and IB in the negative direction. So in the equivalent voltage form, I would put in this for what the current is. So under these circumstances, I would have three equations and three unknowns, which is better than five equations and five unknowns. Okay. So the node method, we're going to automatically satisfy the voltage sum rule by thinking about voltages as being like altitudes, which is how they are. So now the only unknowns are the voltage at this node and the voltage at that node, assuming that I pick one node, and usually it's pretty obvious which one you want that to be ground, 0 volts. And then you just apply current conservation. So for VA, the current that's flowing in here depends on the voltage drop across that resistor, which is V minus VA. So I have V minus VA that's flowing in through R1, and I have VB minus VA that's flowing in through R3, and I have 0 minus VA that's flowing in this way, and the sum of those things all have to add up to 0. And this becomes really mechanical really fast, that you take the far minus the home for all of the connections, and you can pretty quickly write down without a lot of thinking what these equations are. They tend to be a little bit uglier because they have big numbers typically in the denominator. Resistances are typically kilo or mega ohms. But you know, from a calculator point of view, who cares? And fewer equations is a lot simpler. So questions on those three Kirchhoff's laws methods? Well, let's take a look at some kind of complications that can occur. So if we take a look at this formula, and we're thinking about solving this with the node method, which I'm pretty much always solving things with the node method. If we pick a voltage to be 0, I'm going to pick B to be 0 because everything is kind of up from there with those batteries oriented the way they are.
So you just have to pick one node to be 0?
Yes. And it is arbitrary. You can pick anything you want to be 0. But in real circuits, there usually is a real ground, and you might as well choose that to be 0. You don't have to, but you might as well. So here, it's not. Typically, people put ground as low as possible on these circuit diagrams, just to remind you, but that's not how this diagram is drawn. But this is the one that seems to be very reasonable to call 0 volts, because it's certainly the lowest voltage. Everything is going uphill from here. There's no reason you can't have negative voltages, but uphill, I like positive numbers, saves a term. So VA is no longer an unknown. Right? VA is exactly equal to E1, and VC is exactly equal to E2. So really the only unknown in this equation is VD. And for VD, we would be writing that the current that's flowing in through R1 is going to be E1 minus VD, and the current that's flowing in through R2 is going to be epsilon 2 minus VD, and that's divided by R2. And the current that's flowing in through R3 is going to be 0 minus VD divided by R3. So one equation and one unknown in order to solve this problem. The current through this resistor is known, right? Because you know what the voltage drop is across it, right? It's E2 minus E1. So you can immediately figure out what I0 is if anybody asks.
And another thing is that you don't have any know about arrows, right?
Yeah, there are no arrows. And I guess I didn't stress that. With the usual method, you have to put arrows down, and it doesn't matter which way you put those arrows, but then you just have to follow them. If the actual current is flowing in the opposite direction of that arrow, then you're going to just get a negative value for that current. So it's an arbitrary choice that you need to make at the beginning, is to assign those arrows. No arrows in the node method. there basically are still arrows in the mesh method. There's, say, you do have to put a different sign anytime you're using that voltage rule. Okay, so how about this guy? And let's bring back this resistor. Otherwise, there is no distinction between B and D. So now this is a little bit trickier. VA is now not a known number because it depends on how much current there's flowing through R5. So now we do have three different unknowns, and we're going to need to solve them. So if we thinking about this node A, how much current is going to be, and I'm going to make the same choice I did before, I'm going to call the voltage at B0, how much current is going to be flowing through R5? Well, there are lots of ways of thinking about it, but what I like to think about is, first of all, for any series segment, I can rearrange the order of those things any way I want. So I can flip around R5 and E1 if I want, and then it's perfectly clear that the voltage across R5 is E1 minus VA. So for any series segment, you can rearrange the guys any way you want. So what I'm going to have then is that E1 minus VA, that's the voltage, effectively, that's the voltage across this resistor, divided by R5, that's the current that's flowing into that guy. For this loop here, it's perfectly clear, right? It's VC minus VA divided by R0. And for D, it's going to be the same thing, right? VD minus VA divided by R1. So otherwise, it's going to work exactly normally. You only, when you have these sort of voltage batteries in the circuit, which is actually a pretty rare circumstance in real life, you're just going to have to count that part of the real voltage drop between this isn't across this resistor. Some fraction of it is in E1. Okay. So here's another circuit. And again, in terms of choosing something to be ground, I mean, B is a pretty obvious choice. It's all uphill from any one of those. If I use my trick of rearranging the order, then I can swap around R1 and E1. And then the voltage drop across the series combination of R1 and R4 is just E1 to V1. So here I would have then that E1 minus VA divided by the series combination of R1 and R4, that's going to be the current that's flowing into this guy here. The current that's flowing in through this R2, here the guy is already connected to zero, so the voltage drop across this resistor is going to be E2 minus VA divided by R2. And again, using the swap of these two guys, the voltage drop across the series combination of R3 and R5 is going to be E3 minus VA divided by R3 plus R5. So all of those things have to add up to zero. And this was the only unknown. So it's just a simple linear equation. Okay, questions? So I think in 200, you pretty much only have dealt with batteries, but there are equivalent things called current sources, which produce us, so a battery produces a definite voltage independent of the current that's flowing through the battery. A current source produces a specified current independent of the voltage drop across it. And those are both idealizations. You might know that as you draw current from a battery, the voltage goes down, right? Which is why when you start your car, you turn on the starter motor of your car, the lights dim because the starter motor is drawing a huge amount of current and the voltage on the 12-volt battery goes down. So same thing with current sources. If they have to fight a huge voltage drop, they probably aren't going to produce a constant current. But In real circuits, current sources and batteries are actually pretty common these days. And so you deal with them pretty much exactly the way you would, the way I hope you would think, right? If there's a current source in one of these legs, then I know what the current is going into this, into that particular leg. It's whatever is specified by this current source. So it turns out that field effect transistors, FETs, are good examples of current sources. Well, you know what transistors are, right? So something else. So obviously the world isn't made out of inductors, resistors, and capacitors, and what you want to do is take analog electronics in order to learn about how transistors work. They're the big guy out, and I understand a really nice guy is teaching it next year. So we've got transistors like this that are the first type of approximately speaking, the first type of transistors that were produced that are called bipolar transistors, and we have FETs, field effect transistors, that are these days more common. So what's inside your computer are zillions of FETs. So, I don't know, you might ask if, and you know, maybe I'm putting on my electronics hat too early, if real circuits have transistors in them in abundance, probably more transistors than resistors in a modern computer, is all of this time spent on Kirchhoff's laws wasted? And the answer, as you might guess, is no. That is to say that we can treat transistors, at least approximately, as linear circuit elements, and we can fold them into this story just like we folded in inductors and capacitors without undue changes in what you're learning. One kind of difference between, well, so we already know that real batteries don't have a constant voltage. And if you push them, they're not going to act like they always have the voltage V across them. And the same thing applies with transistors. They have a comfort zone, and if you push them outside of their comfort zone, then they're going to go nonlinear, and then you can't use the simple sort of results that we've been talking about. Okay. I guess I forgot to open up my pack. So I think we've gone through 100 transparencies. And soon we'll go through 200 transparencies. Say again? At the end of this, I use permanent because they don't, except for these, because then they don't smear. So they could be yours forever for the right price. Power. Right. So, in DC circuits, the watts, that was the voltage times the current. But now that we're doing AC circuits, the voltage isn't a constant and the current isn't a constant, so the product of those two is going to be constantly varying, right? So when the current goes to zero, the power is instantaneously going to go to zero. So for a real device like the light bulb in this thing, the power that's being delivered by NSP isn't at all a constant. It's varying all the time. But it's varying a 60th of a second, so really what we're going to concern ourselves with is the average power. How much power is going to be delivered over one cycle? And what we're going to want to do then is to calculate the average. I'm using this overline for average, and maybe I'll find something that's darker. So what we need is the average of the voltage times the current. And I don't know, let's start out with this relatively simple. So let's think about the current being some maximum times cosine of omega t, and there very well may be some phase difference between the current and the voltage. So let's think about the voltage being some amplitude times cosine of omega t with some sort of phase shift. What's going to be the average of these two things multiplied together? So we can use some trigonometric identities. The cosine of omega t plus phi, that's equal to the cosine of omega t times the cosine of phi minus the sine of omega t times the sine of phi. So if I bring in my cosine and I try and average these things together, what I'm going to get for the average power is then I've got these real constants I'm thinking about currently, V naught and I naught, and then I'm going to have the average of cosine squared omega t times cosine phi when this term hits that term. Of course, cosine phi is a constant. And then I'm going to have minus sine of omega t cosine of omega t, all of that times the sine of phi. And I'm going to want to average those guys. And from Fourier or from this class or from any number of things, I hope you know that the cosine, of course, itself is going to vary between plus minus 1. And it's kind of no surprise that it averages to a half. Is that a question?
Yeah.
So that's sine of phi.
And is it just multiplied by that?
Yes.
Part?
Yep. So that comes from multiplying this times this term. So the average value of cosine squared is a half. And you know that sine and cosine are orthogonal, so the average value is going to be 0. So what we have then is the average power is 1 half V naught I naught times the cosine of phi. We can distribute this 1 half as a bunch of square roots, right? Because you remember that the RMS voltage is the peak voltage divided by the square root of 2. And similarly for the RMS current. And this is really why we define RMS the way we do. So what we're going to get is VRMS, which is what a meter would read, times the RMS current, all times the cosine of phi. OK, so the cosine of phi is called the power factor. And it indicates what fraction of the current voltage ends up as actual energy that's being used up. So for example, if you take a capacitor and plug it into 120 volt 60 cycle source, you know that there isn't anything that's going to get hot, right? There isn't any energy that's being dissipated. And that's because the angle between the current and the voltage under the situation is going to be 90 degrees. That is to say that phi is going to be, turns out, minus 90 degrees. And so there's no power that's being dissipated. Same thing if I put an inductor between the 120 power volts. Under those circumstances, this phase shift angle would be plus 90 degrees. And the cosine of 90 degrees is 0, so there'd be no power being dissipated. Even though there would be big currents flowing, the current and the voltage would be 90 degrees out of phase, which results in zero power actually being consumed. So one of the homework problems deals with the practical fact that even though your bill from NSP says that you bought so many kilowatt hours, it's not actually watts that you pay for. What NSP bills you for is the current that you're drawing times 120 volts with no power factor included. So if you plug a capacitor into that plug, while it's not going to actually draw any power, it is going to draw current, and NSP is going to bill you for it. They just measure the current and say, and they have good reasons for doing that, because, for example, their loss, that current is going to have to go through their wires, and there's going to be I squared R losses in their wires. They'll have to make up for that. Okay, so particularly things that have inductors in them, capacitors not being so common, particularly things that have inductors in them, like motors or these fluorescent light bulbs, they have a quite noticeable power factor. That is to say, the current that they would draw literally from NSP is a lot more current than the wattage would suggest. And since
so they're expensive.
Well, so they're cheaper than an incandescent light bulb, even in their most inefficient form. Basically, because they're intrinsically more efficient. So an incandescent light bulb like these produces a lot of infrared light, which we can't actually see. So almost all of the light that's being produced is wasted under these circumstances, whereas these fluorescent lights mostly produce visible light. So there's a huge efficiency advantage in fluorescent versus incandescent. There's like a 50% disadvantage from this power factor effect. But you can solve this power factor effect. You don't have to continue to pay NSP too much money. And what one of the homework problems says is if you have, so this is the fluorescent tube, by putting a capacitor like that, it turns out you can cut the power factor to zero and reduce the current that you're getting from NSP. So these power factor correcting capacitors are part of any efficient implementation of fluorescent light bulbs. Incidentally, they were not included when the building was renovated 10 years ago, but they are being implemented with even more efficient devices these days. Say again? Well, it's renovated. You're saying it all looks pretty old the way it is, huh? Well, this room, for example, had fixed tables. Yeah, fixed tables. And there was none of that nice thing in the back that we can store junk on. So once we had that storage area, we could fill it with junk. Say again? Well, most of that junk has come from the observatory since. So there's a lot of junk at the observatory, which none of you got to see since you didn't go out to the observatory. It's not as junky as the basement, but it has its parts. It has its parts. Yes. Yes. I'm in the department. I'm the guy who doesn't want to throw out the junk. I can only say that I'm better than my wife, which is, it's the only case I can say that about, so I have to work for the best. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about resonance. But it really is, my wife. So there are rooms, so she's a quilter, there are rooms piled high with bunches of material. And those rooms used to have cats. So when the cat died, it started to be filled up with material. Good reason to have more cats, I guess. I guess I believe that. Okay, so we've done this before, but let's do it one more time. So this is your basic series LRC circuit. And just to remind you how you did this in 200, you talked about phasor diagrams. And what you said is that there was a rotating vector that was the current. And then there would be a voltage that was ahead of the current, 90 degrees ahead of the current, that was the voltage across the inductor. And there was a voltage that was 90 degrees behind it, that was the voltage across the across the inductor. And green, the voltage across the resistor would be exactly in phase with the current across the current that's flowing through that circuit. And of course, this whole thing is rotating with an angle that's equal to omega t. And boy, I think I've said before, this should really remind you of e to the I omega t. Right? So here we have an impedance that has an I in it, which is going to shift things ahead by 90 degrees. Here we have an impedance that has a minus I in it, which is going to push things behind by 90 degrees. And here we have an impedance that is real. So the voltage across the resistor is going to be in phase with the corresponding current. Okay, so now let's work it in a more modern way. So we have a series circuit, so we know that the total impedance is the impedance of the inductor plus the impedance of the capacitor plus the impedance of the resistor. And now we can simplify this maybe a little bit by pulling out an I. And we know then that if we think about the voltage as having some amplitude and a rotating vector, and the current as having some amplitude and a rotating vector, then V equals IR, now generalized into V equals IZ, is immediately going to crank down to, canceling off the e to the I omega t's, that the peak voltage is equal to Z times the peak current. And this impedance is going to be exactly what's specified up there. In terms of magnitudes, and usually actually what is specified is the voltage that you have on the Wavetech. So really we're interested usually in what the current is, which is going to be the voltage divided by the impedance. Now in terms of magnitudes as opposed to phases, we'll come to phases in a second, the magnitude, the peak value of the current is going to be the magnitude of the voltage divided by the magnitude of the impedance. And it's pretty easy to find the magnitude of a complex number. You just take the real part and square it, and take the complex part and square it, and then take the quadratic square root combination of it. So I'm going to get R squared plus omega L minus 1 over omega C, quantity squared, all of that square rooted. Okay. That's a V naught up top, no omega up top. So if we kind of think about how this works, if we make a plot of the current versus the frequency, might as well be the angular frequency. If omega is equal to basically zero, then 1/0 is going to be a huge number in the denominator, and I'm going to get very little current that flows. If omega, and what's happening here is that for low frequencies, the capacitor acts like a big resistor, and so the current is going to be pretty small. If omega goes to infinity, then we've got a big number in the denominator, and we're going to get a small current. And that's because the inductor is blocking things up. So if we've got zeros at both ends, that, you know, it has to look kind of like that. It has to be kind of a bell-shaped curve. So there's one frequency at which we get the biggest possible response, and we can see that in order to make this thing as big as possible, we can't do anything about the resistance, but this term we can do something about. We can make it zero by having omega L equal to 1/(ωc), which is to say that omega squared is 1/LC, which is the usual resonance condition. Okay, so the amplitude gets huge at the resonant value. How can we assign a number to the width of this curve? And there isn't a super standard way of defining the widths of things. What pretty commonly occurs in electronics, and I guess other areas too, is we take the full width at a value that is down by a factor of square root of 2 from the maximum. Okay, so this is the full width, and it's usually described as at half maximum, but it's maximum of power, and power goes like I squared, so in order to have half the power, we're going to have 1/√2 of the current. Okay, so let's just focus on half of that half, the half width, let me call that delta omega. And in order for this to be down by the square root of 2, this term here wants to be equal to R, so that when it's squared and combined with this R, we get something that's twice as big under the radical, so we get something that's square root down. So to find the frequency this particular additional frequency that we want. So what we want is that omega L minus 1 over omega C evaluated at omega naught plus delta omega, that wants to equal R. And we could solve this exactly. It's kind of an ugly quadratic equation, but people usually don't bother to do it. They usually make a Taylor series approximation. So if this quantity is by definition zero at omega naught, and you know, of course, that a function can be approximated at some point x naught by the value of the function at x naught plus the derivative evaluated at x naught times delta x, right? There are more terms in this Taylor series expansion. So if I play that game just to get a simple answer, the value of the function evaluated at omega naught was zero, right? We were at the peak. And if I take the derivative of that, I get L, the derivative of 1 over omega is minus 1 over omega squared, so I get 1 over omega squared C. And if I evaluate that at omega naught and multiply it all by delta omega, well, omega naught squared is 1 over LC squared, so this quantity here is just going to be 2L. So in order for this quantity to equal R, delta omega wants to be R over 2L. And what that means is that the full width, 2 omega, is going to be R over L. Okay, so, yes. Question? Say again?
So why the impedances combined at the value of omega not plus delta omega equals R? And why we want to get to that?
So we wanted all of this thing to equal R, okay. So that what we got is 2R squared in the denominator.
Oh, okay.
So it was down then by a factor of square root of 2 compared to what it is when this is 0.
Okay.
So this is in order to get this half width at half maximum. And then we multiply the half width by 2 to get the full maximum. Well, what we really care about is the relative size of omega. That is to say, is this delta omega a thousandth of omega, or is it, you know, equal to omega? Is this a broad or a big maximum? So if we're going to make comparisons about big or small, we need things that are unitless. So typically what people describe is the Q factor, which is the value of the frequency at resonance divided by the full width at half max. And I guess I'll call it 2 delta omega with my new notation. So if we just work it out, what we've got then is omega naught divided by R over L, or omega naught L divided by R. And this Q factor is, as I assume you talked about it in mechanics, it's describable in lots of different ways. So for example, approximately speaking, how many oscillations do you get in a damped harmonic oscillator? And roughly speaking, you get Q oscillations before the amplitude goes down by a factor of E. There's another way of, so if we write it in this form, then one way you can think about it is this is the impedance of the inductor divided by the impedance of the capacitor. But remember that omega is, omega squared is 1 over LC. So we could also write this as 1 over R omega naught C, in which case it's the impedance of the capacitor divided by the impedance of the resistor. Take your pick. Okay, so for highly tuned circuits, we want Q that is real big. Q of 10, 100, a million is achievable under extreme circumstances. Okay, so these are electrically resonant circuits, and last semester, I assume you talked about mechanically resonant circuits. All well and good. Oh, I guess I didn't want to totally neglect the idea of the phase shift. So if we go back to this equation, the phase, I guess this is the right equation. If we go back to this equation, the phase shift between the current and the voltage is just the phase of z, right? So if z is some magnitude of z times e to the I phi, then that's going to be the phase shift between the current and the voltage, right? Because if we put together the e to the I omega t's, the voltage is now going to go like e to the I omega t plus phi. It's going to be shifted by phi. So what is that phase shift? Well, so z was equal to r plus I omega l minus 1 over omega c. So if we make a plot of the real part of z and the imaginary part of z, we've got, you know, pretty much like we had before. We've got a resistive part that's on the real axis, and it'd be nice if I chose the same colors as I did before. And we've got a inductive piece that is in the positive direction, and we've got a inductive piece that's in the negative direction. And this whole complex vector is that guy. And so this angle we can calculate as being the net y component, which is omega l minus 1 over omega c, all divided by r. Okay, so if omega goes to 0, then what we're going to have is a huge capacitive impedance. So we're going to get the inverse tangent of minus infinity, which means that the phase shift is going to go to minus 90 degrees. And if omega goes to infinity, then this term is 0, and we're finding the inverse tangent of infinity, in which case phi is going to be 90 degrees at resonance, where these two terms cancel. The phase shift is 0. Okay, so if we were to make kind of a similar plot as we made before, except now we're going to plot phase versus omega, the phase is going to start at 90 degrees, it's going to go through 0 at resonance, and then it's going to go to plus 90 degrees. And the sharpness of this change, that is to say the range over which omega changes from minus 90 degrees to plus 90 degrees, is again relates to Q. So for high Q, we get a very sudden shift between lagging and leading by 90 degrees. Okay, familiar stuff from mechanics? Stuff that you knew that you once learned in mechanics. You must have talked about all of this in mechanics. Yeah, and you do this all again in the torsional pendulum with Jim. It's a nice experiment. Get to repeat all of this stuff. Okay. So who's already taken electronics? Three, four. So you guys already know, have already met this guy, right?
Aren't they so unlucky? Because they don't get you.
we'll see what the people decide. So then we've got Thevenin. So what does Thevenin say? So in the simplest possible case, if we have some complicated circuit that has, you know, voltages and resistors and current sources, some big ugly mess, and it's got two wires that are coming out of it, then what happens with these two wires is exactly the same as if you had a single voltage source and a single resistor. No matter how complicated the circuit is, pull any two random wires out of that circuit, and they act as if that whole circuit could be reduced to a voltage source and a resistor. If we add capacitors in there, then of course this thing at a frequency, then this battery is going to be replaced by a Wavetech, and this resistor is going to be replaced by a general impedance. Not a resistor, not a capacitor, but just some complex number. If we put in transistors in there, then approximately we can do this same process. But again, if we push the transistors to their nonlinear regime, then things are pretty complicated. So approximately speaking, what Thevenin's theory says is that, you know, your amplifier, for example, the two leads that go to your speaker can be simplified. It's got all sorts of complicated electronics on the inside, but it can be thought of as being a power source with an impedance. And the equivalent impedance is called the output impedance of the device. If it's something that you think about as being mostly in output, your speaker, while not super complicated, it has to be the same way. It's got two pins being connected to it, and since we usually think of it as something that is connected to output, we talk about its input impedance. And these are numbers that are usually known if you look at the specifications. They're critically important numbers that describe in one number how the whole system works. Now, there are no power sources for this speaker, so it's not going to have a battery. It's just going to be equivalent to some simple impedance. So you have 4-ohm speakers, an 8-ohm speaker, 16-ohm speakers, that sort of summary value for the device. Now, it might be worth commenting that in general, this impedance will depend on the driving frequency. And so the impedance of your speaker does depend on the driving frequency. But they try and design those speakers so that over a broad range of frequencies, one number, one input impedance describes the result. Okay, so input impedance and output impedance are kind of results of Thevenin's theorem, which we're not going to bother to prove, that any complicated device, certainly for batteries and resistors, if we make AC sources, it just means that this thing can be some impedance. If we add transistors, then it's true as long as we don't push it too hard. Approximately speaking, any device can be thought of as a resistor in series with a power source. There's a partner theorem called Norton's theorem, which says if you don't like batteries and resistors, you could instead have current sources in parallel to a resistor being equivalent to your circuit. But people usually are happier thinking about batteries than they are about current sources. So Thevenin typically wins out over Norton in kind of the number of hits you would get on Wiki. Okay, so let's think about the typical student problem. You've got your amplifier here, which has some sort of output impedance, and you want to put as much power into this speaker as possible so that your RA is unhappy. So how can we get as much power transferred from device A to device B? And the amplifier, remember, can be thought about as just being a device that has some sort of output impedance. And whatever we're connecting it to can be thought of as having some sort of input impedance with some not for a speaker, but to talk about this more generally, some sort of power source connected to it. How can we get the most possible power transferred between these two devices? Well, let's start with the simplest case, which is to think about these things in terms of resistors. And then hopefully we'll have some time to go on to think about the more general case, or maybe I'll just quote the result, I don't know. So if we have this situation with batteries, then what we have is a net voltage drop across these two resistors, the output resistance of that guy and the input impedance of the other guy, and the net voltage drop across them is going to be just the voltage difference between these two things. In any case, a constant. So the current that's going to flow through everything here is, of course, just the voltage divided by the series combination of the resistances. And the power that's going to be dissipated in this resistor is just I squared R. So we're going to have V squared divided by R1 plus R2 all time, oops, RO I and I squared, I squared R. So how can we maximize that power? Well, if you think about it, if the input impedance goes to zero, we're going to get zero, right? If the input impedance goes to infinity, we're going to have infinity over infinity squared, and infinity over infinity squared is 1 over infinity, which is zero. So under both of those circumstances, we're going to get no power transfer. So someplace between zero resistance and infinite resistance is how we get the most power into our secondary device. So it's a maximum minimum problem. We want to maximize this function. And it'll be a little bit convenient to factor out an RO squared. So if I factor out the output impedance squared, what I'm going to get up top is R in over R out, and what I'm going to get down below is 1 plus R in over R out, that whole quantity squared. And now I can just call this ratio of the input impedance to the output impedance X, and what I want to do then is to maximize the function, that is 1 plus X squared. Right? So if I plug in x equals 0, I get 0. If I plug in x equals infinity, I get infinity over infinity squared, which is 0. This function has to look kind of like that, and we're trying to pick out the peak. And you know, since calculus, you know the way you pick out peaks is by taking the derivative and setting it equal to 0. So what we've got is take the derivative of the numerator, and I get 1 plus x squared from that. Take the derivative of the denominator, and I get a minus 2. The x goes along for the ride, and I have a 1 plus x cubed. If I seek a common denominator of 1 plus x cubed, what I'm going to get is 1 plus x minus 2x, which is 1 minus x. And so to make this thing to be 0, I want x to be equal to 1, which says that I want the input resistance to match the output resistance. Okay, so this is called impedance matching. And we're going to try and show this more generally with complex numbers, but let me tell you what the result is in general, and that is that we want the complex conjugate of the input impedance to equal the output impedance. So we want to have the opposite imaginary part and the same real part in order to maximize the power transfer from device A to device B. Okay, so if we're going to deal with complex numbers, we're going to need it is helpful to prove a little kind of useless theorem. Well, so there are some things that are capital T true, and this isn't one of them. So this is something that is just a tricky shortcut, as opposed to being something that is importantly true. Okay? So what we know for the power, what we want, is we want to calculate what the average value is of the real part, because that's what's real, the real part of the voltage times the real part of the current, time averaged.
What's that subscript?
There's no subscript. This is R and E for real part. I and M stands for imaginary part. So what we want to do is to calculate this quantity, and it turns out that it equals 1/2 the real part of the voltage complex conjugated times the current. Okay, so this is not a deep important result. This is a quick shortcut that has, as I say, no particularly deep meaning. So let's think about it kind of in more general results. So I have the real part of some function f, and I have the real part of some function g, and this f and g are both made out of the usual game, right, where f is equal to f naught e to the I omega t, and g is equal to g naught e to the I omega t. And f naught, I'm saying, is going to be a plus ib, and g naught is going to be c plus id. Okay, so if I look at the real part of F, it's going to be A times cosine of omega T minus B times sine of omega T. Everyone believe that? The I's giving me the minus sign. And the real part of G, correspondingly, is going to be C times the cosine of omega T minus D times the sine of omega T. We know that the average value of sine times cosine is 0, so the only contributions I'm going to get are with cosine and sine, and both of those are going to give me 1/2. The minus signs are going to disappear because under those circumstances, I'm going to get the minus sine squared. So what I'm going to get at the end of this for the average value is 1/2 of AC plus BD. Okay, so let's see that I'm going to get the same thing by taking that quantity there. So V complex conjugated, that's going to be equal to A minus IB times e to the minus I omega t. Oops, I guess I should have called this f. F complex conjugate is equal to that. And g, of course, is equal to c plus id times e to the I omega t. If I multiply those two things together, the e to the I omega t's cancel, and I only care about the real part. One real part I get is from a times c. The other real part I get is where those two come together, and that's going to give me B times D. Okay, so not a deep important result, but just a quick way of calculating things like power factors without giving it a whole lot of thought. Okay, so for our particular circuit, what we've got is a net power source, the voltage value from the input and output combined. We've got, I'll write it as a resistor, but we've got, and I'm going to write ones and twos this time, I've got the output impedance of the first device and the input impedance of the second device. And I know that the current that's going to flow is going to be whatever this voltage value is divided by Z1 plus Z2. And the voltage drop across this guy is going to be given by the current times the corresponding impedance. I'll put a tilde there and have this be V tilde. So what I want is the average value of the voltage times the current, and what that's going to give me is this thing complex conjugated, so 1/2, the overall 1/2 doesn't matter because we're maximizing things, Z1 plus Z2 complex conjugated, that's from this term, and then we've got Z2 over Z1 plus Z2. And we want the real part of this, right? Well, the denominator is real automatically because it's Z times Z complex conjugated. So the only thing we're going to care about is the real part of Z2. In order to make the magnitude of a complex number as small as possible, we want to cancel the imaginary parts. Right? So we want that the imaginary part of Z1 plus Z2 equals 0. That's the best we can do for the denominator. What are we left with then? Well, we're left with just the real part in the denominator. Right? So in the denominator, we're going to have R1 plus R2 squared. And in the numerator, we just want the real part of that guy, so it's just R2. And we already know how we maximize that. We maximize that by setting the R1 equal to R2. So we want the real parts of Z1 and Z2 to match, and we want the imaginary parts of Z1 and Z2 to cancel in order to maximize the power dissipation. Okay. So having said that maximizing the power distribution solves the student's problem, right? You want to get as much noise possible out of the speaker. It's actually not as common a situation as you might think. So it is very common in physics, of course, to connect device A to connect to device B. And if we wanted to get the maximum power transfer, we certainly want to follow the rules that we've specified. Impedance matching is the shorthand name for that rule. But pretty frequently, if we actually did impedance matching, we would be disturbing the circuit a whole lot, and we would be in danger of driving its transistors into nonlinear regions. So really what we want pretty frequently is we want to make sure that the device that we're connecting it to has no effect on the device that the origin of the signal. And so if this guy isn't going to affect this guy very much, typically what we're going to want is to have its input impedance be a lot bigger than the output impedance of the original device. Okay, so circuit blocks that are connected together in real life usually don't satisfy impedance matching. They usually satisfy impedance mismatching, so that the output impedance of what you're connecting to is a lot bigger than the input impedance that you're driving. Okay, and the exceptions are typically when? Well, typically if you have some sort of complicated physics experiment, the very first step, you might want to transfer as much of the power that's being produced physically to your amplifiers. So you might want to have impedance matching at the beginning. And if you're interested in the student type problem, you might want to have the maximum amount of power in the output stage. But typically for all of the in-between stages, impedance mismatching is more common than impedance matching. But nevertheless, we have this important theorem that to get the maximum amount of power from point A to point B, same real part, opposite imaginary parts for the impedances. Well, I had hoped to start a little bit of the next chapter, but it didn't happen. Questions? Okay, so you remember that we skip over, so we're on, so what we've been talking about is chapter 13. We skip over the next two chapters, which are interesting. They are plasma physics and superconductors, but we're going to jump to chapter 16. My guess is that the exam will cover all of 16 and then maybe the first section of chapter 17, which deals with light. At least that's the plan. And of course, the stuff that came since the last exam, which is a lot of magnetization and induction.